Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Last month, the Bureau of Labor Statistics released a list of the fastest growing occupations. Number 10, physical therapy assistant. Number 9, genetic counselor. Number 8, occupational therapy assistant. Number 7, helper, like a brick mason helper or tile setter helper. Number 6, diagnostic medical sonographer. That's people who do ultrasounds. Number 5, interpreter and translator. Number 4, insulation worker. Number 3, home health aide. Number 2, personal care aide. I'm not sure what the difference is. And number 1, drum roll, industrial and organizational psychologist. Ah, not just an aide who's going to make $10 an hour. In fact, median salary, and of course it's higher in the Bay Area, $83,580, and the career is projected to grow in terms of the number of jobs between now and 2022 by 53%. What is this under-the-radar career, industrial and organizational psychologist? Well, with me to answer that question, and perhaps more relevant to most of us, and you certainly, because I'm not looking for a job, how are these guys and women, industrial and organizational psychologists, affecting how employees get selected, as well as how they're treated in the workplace? With me is past president of the Society for Industrial and Organizational Psychology and senior vice president at Development Dimensions International, Doug Reynolds. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you, Marty. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Good. Well, so what is an industrial and organizational psychologist?
Well, you know, let's step back and let me say something about the field in general, and I'll tell you what practitioners do. But first, I have to say, as you've already demonstrated, the name is a mouthful, and we know that. So we tend to call ourselves IO psychologists. So
okay.
I'll probably use that term because the other's kind of longer. But the field itself is really the scientific study of behavior in the workplace, or more simply, it's the application of psychology to work and organizations. So what does somebody do? What does that look like if you're in that field? I'd say in a general way, what an IO psychologist does is they start by looking at a business problem that involves people, and they'll analyze the aspects of that problem, and they'll bring tools to bear on that, things they create or things that have been created in the past. They'll implement those. They'll study their impact and analyze the results, report back, and ideally continuously improve to understand the workplace better, to understand what makes people tick and work best in the workplace and be satisfied in the workplace.
So we need an example here. Give us an example.
Yeah. Well, there's so many to choose from, but Let me pick on a recent project that Procter & Gamble has done. They've been getting some attention for this. So P&G's business problem from a hiring perspective is, how do you hire people that you intend to carry through their careers? Now, this is a cultural thing at P&G. They tend to hire people for a career. So the people they promote tend to be people that they've hired long ago. So that initial hiring decision is really quite critical. So that's the business problem. What the team of IO psychologists there did was look at how they can improve that initial hiring decision. They built a test using some really long-standing technologies in the psychological measurement realm around intelligence and figural reasoning. They wanted this tool to apply globally, so figural reasoning was very useful to them because it doesn't use words. It's basically solving problems with shapes. So they built a test that uses that and deployed it on the Internet in a technology format called adaptive testing. which allows each person that takes the test to get a different version. That keeps cheating down, and they're deploying that around the world to hire graduates into their management track sequence.
So you're saying basically it's an intelligence test that's using, rather than words, so that it could be globally applicable, it uses symbols to create the same kind of problems, the kind of reasoning problems and abstract thinking problems that would exist in the dirty word intelligence test. But wouldn't a test like that, wouldn't Procter & Gamble, especially because it's a big, prominent company, wouldn't that test likely be challenged by the Obama administration's Department of Justice because it would have a disparate impact, negative impact on candidates of color? I mean, that's almost all measures of intelligence show a tremendous gap between Asians and whites and blacks on such measures.
Yeah, it's that is a common issue you run into, especially on tests that tap into intelligence-related things. You're gonna pull out those social differences. So, I think that's part of what the IO psychologist needs to be attuned with. There's federal guidelines and regulations. It really doesn't matter that much who's in the White House. There's federal agencies that are charged with monitoring issues like adverse impact. So a company that's doing this right is going to recognize that from the start, be very careful about using tools and procedures that have a clear connection to the business purpose, and demonstrate that with data. So they'll do what's called a validation study to demonstrate that scores on the test are related to subsequent performance on the job. And you can use that evidence to defend the process, and that's really the process where the IO psychologist is getting involved to guide the company through that. So a well-designed test should stand up to that kind of scrutiny.
In the real world, you know, the cost of a validation study is enormous. You need thousands of people over a many-year period, cost a fortune. Won't most companies simply say, the hell with it, I'll forget about the, you know, trying to prove the validity of intelligence to some intelligence test as predictive of work validity. We know it's true, but it's going to show disparate impact. So to hell with it, we're just going to rely on, you know, whether you got a bachelor's degree from someplace or not. Aren't the pressures to avoid a disparate impact lawsuit simply going to make companies say, to hell with it, I'll just use less valid criteria?
Yikes, yeah. Well, there's a lot of places to go from that. You know, you might end up in the same place if you use the bachelor's degree, one thing I'd say. But the validation studies, they can be costly. If you were my client, I would say, you know, it doesn't have to be that burdensome. There are techniques that have involved in the practice of IO psychology that make validation studies less time-consuming, lower sample sizes. Many techniques have evolved to allow you to use appropriate tools and justify them with good data. So, some companies are going to do huge validity studies that take many years, and they're constantly updating them, but it doesn't have to be that complicated. Essentially, what you're doing is asking the question, is the tool that I'm using, the procedure that I'm using to hire people, have a basis that can be proven with data.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt. We're getting a little too deep in the weeds here. My listeners are going to be more interested in such practical matters as IO psychologists do a lot of work in trying to help companies and nonprofits and government agencies do a better job of hiring wisely. What kinds of instruments now are common for employee selection, and how well do they contribute to predicting employees' performance?
Sure, there's a pretty wide range of tools in the toolbox. Some we've already touched on, cognitive type measures, personality tests, things that people would sort of stereotypically think of. But I'd say over the past couple of decades, the field has really moved in a direction to try to evolve measures that have a closer connection to work. So you see tools that sort of fall in a class called situational judgment tests, where you're not answering abstract problems. You're given a problem that somebody in the job you're applying for could face every day. Critical problem that if you don't have an intuitive sense for how you might work through that sort of thing, you'd be at a disadvantage versus folks that might have a better sense for how to solve problems like that. So that's one example. I think if you continue that train of thought, there's a lot of work going on in the use of simulations. That's not necessarily new. People have been using behavioral simulations like role plays and inbox exercises for a long time. But all that stuff's being computerized now,
sure.
So it's easier to deploy. A lot more companies are using them because you're not going through as much of the difficult parts of building them from scratch. You can sort of rent them off the internet.
You know, it's amazing how much of this is common sense. Obviously, you know, whether the delivery system, whether it's a computer or, you know, a role play or whatever, clearly if you are, for example, going to be working as anything, as a salesperson on an assembly line, whatever, as an airline pilot, doing a simulation is going to be a more valid predictor of success than, for example, I do enjoy I don't like ridiculing in general, but I do like ridiculing personality tests. Because my PhD is in this field, and you know, tests like the Myers-Briggs and the DISC and all the rest of these personality measures that attempt to reduce you to some categories have little more validity than a horoscope, and yet they're widely used. I'm a big fan of simulations. Am I being too hard on tests like the Myers-Briggs and the DISC?
Well, you know, Marty, you would have an army of IO psychologists behind you that would completely agree. A lot of the tools that you mentioned have very high, you know, they're popular, high usage rates, but the theory underlying them was, if there was theory at all, it's decades old. Now, I wouldn't pick on the class of personality tests in general and associate it with just those examples. There are very good measures of personality.
What's one? Give me an example. A good, where there's good predictive validity, where indeed knowing which category, which color you are or which whatever, actually has predictive validity in terms of, for example, enabling you to work better in the workplace when you know your personality and you know the other person's, your coworker's personality. I want to hear about a personality test because I am, you know, not current on this. What's a current instrument that really has good enough predictive validity in the area of personality?
Well, there's bunches of them, and I don't want to advocate for any one firm's test, but I'll just give you an example that you'd run across in the literature. There's a test called the NEO, N-E-O. So that is an example of a Big Five measure. So it's looking at what IO psychologists think about the Big Five factors of personality. So it's things like extroversion, agreeableness, conscientiousness, emotional stability, and openness. Mm-hmm. So a measure that's looking at those kinds of characteristics is going to have a real strong scientific foundation. Now, notice that these measures don't categorize you. You're not an NJT or whatever.
INTJ, right.
You could have a standing on any one of those scales. And that's a more complicated way to think about personality. But if you're predicting performance in an environment where personality matters, those would be the tools that I'd lean towards. Now, the other part of your question is, you know, do they have great predictive validity?
Right.
I think the research is showing that personality in general, a personality test isn't going to have some massive correlation with performance. There's a lot of ways to get a job done, and different
personalities
can fit in different ways.
Exactly. And so why buy? You know, when there time is so limited and there is so much potential for error and you want to hire wisely, why wouldn't you throw, because they don't have, predictive validity is all that matters in this case. You know, so why not scrap all that crap and really do most hiring based on simulations, which are clearly job-related and can avoid things like disparate, you know, worry, can survive an attack by a disparate impact lawsuit?
Well, I guess I wouldn't pitch it as an either-or. You know, a good process is going to have multiple inputs. You know, people are complicated creatures, and we're made up of a lot of different characteristics. So a good system is going to maybe use some cognitive testing, some personality testing. Personality testing can be quite useful to help explain some of the patterns you're seeing. You know, you make it through those pieces, maybe a few others, then you go into a simulation. Now,
Doug,
one of the reasons why
Doug,
you,
you know what?
I
have to stop you here, and here's why. You know, you say it could, but unless there's predictive validity data to show that they are indeed not only reliable, but do predictably predict performance on the job, what good is it?
Oh, well, reliable prediction on the job is a prerequisite. So I'm not saying personality is not useful. It may not rise to the level of a cognitive characteristic in its predictive capability, but it's still quite useful. Sometimes you use it, sometimes you don't. But the reason why you may not want to use a simulation on everybody, it's time intensive and it's a little more expensive. The candidates may not want to devote that much time to it either. So there is a cost-benefit trade-off there.
For what it's worth, if I were, I may be wrong, and again, I'm not current in the field, but common sense says to me that it doesn't take that much time to create, and they don't have to be video simulations, although even today video is so inexpensive, to create a half a dozen of the most common difficult situations in which a candidate, whether they're a bank teller or an astronaut going to Mars, the six difficult situations they're most likely to encounter, create a 60-second video with local community college actors or just simply with cartoons, and you ask them, what would you do in this situation? That would seem to be so much more closely job-related that I can't imagine that any personality test, given their limited predictive validity, would be more worth the time. Do you really disagree with that?
No, I do not. I think you're making my case. That's generally what you're advocating is what a lot of IO psychologists would advocate too. It's not that hard. Let's make sure the tools are job-related. So, yeah, if we're getting into personality tests that ask about your relationship with your parents and that sort of thing, you're better off spending your time and effort elsewhere.
Nobody could argue with the theoretical truth that it would be great to know people's personalities and where it would really fit in the job. The problem is, as you said, it's so darn complicated that it can't be measured well in an instrument. It could take weeks to ascertain the little context in which a person, for example, gets along well with others. It's just too multivariate. Anyway, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I'm talking with Doug Reynolds. He is the former past president of the Society for Industrial and Organizational Psychology, and we're talking about what is the fastest growing career according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Results released last month. Industrial and organizational psychologist, euphemistically or abbreviatingly called IO psychologist. There has been one of the things that I had heard that the field is moving toward is companies, for example, like Google, are using big data, massive existing data sets, to help identify criteria for whom to hire. Is, in fact, big data being used, and what is the factor or factors that are seemingly most useful in predicting job performance looking at big data?
Well, yeah, it's a big area that's emerging now. Of course, everyone's trying to figure out what to make of big data. I'd say that there isn't any one finding that's popping out, but people are starting to look at things like, can you look at somebody's LinkedIn profile and get something meaningful from that you can use as a selection tool? There's a lot of interest in that, but there's also a lot of problems with that. Not everybody has a profile.
It's garbage.
Yeah.
You know why it's garbage? Because it's self-report. Studies I know about resumes show 30 to 45% of resumes contain exaggeration or false information. What is a LinkedIn profile other than just an online version of a resume? That's garbage. That's not going to go anywhere.
Exactly. But people are messing around with it. So when you mention big data, that's the sort of thing that people are starting to look at. I think the scientist in us is going to say, well, yeah, you don't use the content of what they're saying. You'd probably say, do they have a profile or not? Yeah, and how many jobs are they reporting? But that's all pretty new stuff. I think there's more sort of classic uses of big data, classic in the sense that we're applying tried and true techniques to massive data sets. So you mentioned Google. One of the things they're doing is dissecting their employee data. So they sort of practice what they preach. They've got a good team internally, and they're pulling apart their things like their employee survey, looking at questions like, what makes a good leader in our environment? And using the data from that survey, using big data analytic techniques, to pull out some themes. Now, the themes they're finding, there's a few points of interest, but I think the themes they find generally sound like good leadership overall. It's things like being a good coach, knowing how to delegate without micromanaging, developing people in their careers. But what's interesting in their findings is that technical skill was actually the eighth-ranked characteristic in their big data analysis. You'd think at Google that might pop up, but like many other environments, being a good leader may look a little different than being a great technologist.
Yep.
And that's the kind of thing that they're bringing back. Now, the important thing about that is it's homegrown. They're using their own data, and that allows them to get insights about their own culture. Even though you could pull some of those same themes out of the literature, the fact that it's homegrown gets people to buy into it, and you can take action on it and implement it far more easily. And that's really where the action is. Who cares about the findings if they sit in a textbook? If you implement it for organizational improvement, now you've got something.
I would love to. It seems to me what a leader does best is two things. There's a data-centric and a people-centric component. Mm-hmm. The data-centric component is the ability to quickly assimilate a large amount of information and make a good prediction about what to do, whether it is what product to buy, who to lay off, where the megatrends are. But it seems to me that leadership on the data side is just being able to, because that we have so much data available, the ability to quickly and intelligently and with predictive accuracy take masses of data and come up with something crystalline that's predictably valid. And on the people side, it's the ability to hire wisely, to use those simulations as a major tool, but the ability to dig deep within a person to see how much drive does he or she really have, how well would he or she play well with others, how much is he or she have that intellectual firepower. That, and then helping those people who they then hire, these leaders, to help them flower. Because we all know leaders who inspire, and we all know leaders who shut people down. It seems to me what I just said in the last 40 seconds, and I'm more than willing to be disabused by you. This is a conversation, not a lecture, of course. That in the end, that's what we should be focusing on in leadership development and in leadership training and in leadership selection. Do you agree or disagree?
Well, and generally, I agree, and you are pulling some things that are well established. So we talk about a task focus for a leader versus a people focus. But the people focus, you gave a lot of emphasis to the hiring decision, and that's part of it. But it's an important but small part. There's so much beyond that in terms of engaging your employees, being a good coach, as you said, not shutting them down, don't micromanage. So many places you can make a misstep. Developing them as people is huge. So a good leader is not only thinking about what they need for their team, but how to keep their people growing and engaged as people. It's part of what you'd want to see in a good leader.
You said that not micromanaging is key, and I would argue with that, and it depends. The great leader does not exert one-size-fits-all leadership. There are indeed some human beings who are their supervisees who really love the structure of micromanaging, or who by nature need extrinsic rewards. They're not intrinsically motivated, but they can, with micromanaging, do a good job. While there are others who it would be a nightmare for them to micromanage them. They would feel disempowered and they should be left alone. So I would argue that the wise leader does not a priori make decisions about things like how much structure to provide, how much micromanaging, but the ability to flex to meet the situation. Do you disagree?
Well, I agree. Reading the situation is going to be critical in reading the person, but you've got to have a direction that you're putting on, too. I'm not sure that you want to raise a leader to coddle the people that demand structure in every single thing. I mean, I'd probably coach that leader to put some attention on bringing that person to a level of independence that's not taking all your time as a leader, because if you spend your time micromanaging, there's something more important, like reading all the data in your environment you mentioned, that you're not going to be able to do. So I think generally I'd agree, but I'd be careful to say that the needs of every individual have to be taken into account.
I agree to some extent, and I also want to point out, this is very important, I've cited this on the show before, the Gallup organization did a poll of 60,000 top managers and asked what was the key to their being effective. And the overwhelmingly modal response was hiring wisely. and then cutting their losses when they got the wrong people. So while the but you said it was only a small part of what they do, and yet in fact, while it may chronologically be temporarily be a small part of what they do, there's nothing more important than, as they said in the book Good to Great, getting the right people on the bus.
So. Yeah, well, I spend my career helping people with hiring decisions, so I'm not going to disagree with you. I think percentage of time-wise, it's a huge impact, but leader to leader, it's probably not where they're spending the bulk of their time.
Right.
Get it right, and if you can get that right, think about the time you're saving and the energy you can put into making the team more effective if you've got the right people on the bus, to use the Good to Great framework.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Doug Reynolds. He is the past president of the Society for Industrial and Organizational Psychology, which is, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics report that just came out last month, the number one fastest growing field. And I've decided, you know, we can easily talk about what does it take to train in it and all that, but I wanted to kind of get immersed into the issues of the field so that you, whether you're thinking of going in this field or not, because chances are you're not, you know, if you're listening to the show, you're probably not jumping and saying, I want to go into a field, but at least you can get into the issues that are really embedded in the field. Are we right now, is our conversation, Doug, getting into indeed the issues that are core to the field?
Marty, you are really hitting the nail on the head. These issues are central to the field. Hiring, leadership development, engaging employees, building culture, those are the kinds of things that are the bread and butter of the IO psychologist.
What I was interested in our conversation, we did talk for a good amount of time, and Doug, I appreciated you having given me all that time before the show to identify what's new and important. And you said there is something new, however, that IO psychology is getting involved in, and you described them as, quote, humanitarian initiatives. Tell us about a specific project like that.
Yeah, there's a bunch of stuff going on in this area. I think what's new is we're trying to bring it more to the surface of the field. Historically, the stereotype, if there was one, of an IO psychologist is sort of a servant of management. And there's so much more to the field than simply making Fortune 500 companies work better. Of course, that's part of what we do. But there's a lot of work going on in things like developing entrepreneurial enterprises in developing countries. There's a bunch of projects that deal with that. There were a team of IOs that got together to help small businesses recover after Katrina. Mm-hmm. So just getting through the mechanics of getting a new staff, getting back up and running, there's a lot of things that IO psychologists could help with. But a more current one that is attracting a lot of attention among our members is helping the issue of bringing veterans back into civilian employment, just a huge national issue for us as we draw down in the Middle East. So there's a higher unemployment among veterans, but yet they've had some great experience. So what's the deal with that gap? How can we apply our skills to help the veteran and help the employer understand the veteran to close that gap a little bit? So we've got a number of folks that are doing things like coaching veterans directly to help, you know, prepare resumes and get them ready to go through what a civilian job search might look like, but also preparing material for employers on what to expect and how to accommodate a vet. There's a lot of activity going on in that area.
Give me a good example or two of something you might put in a report to employers on how the special needs of returning veterans.
Well, yeah, here's an example. You know, one of the things that when you're growing your career as a vet, you're given a lot of direction. You know, you're going to be told where your next assignment is, where your next duty station is. So the idea of, you know, an empowering work environment where you're scanning the environment looking for sort of the next thing to do, that concept may be a little foreign to the vet. It's not to say that they shouldn't do it, but they might be expecting very clear direction, especially in things like, you know, job placement, assignment placement. So how do you bridge that gap? How do you explain your culture and how those decisions are made from a framework where you're saying, you might be used to this model in the military, here's how we do it here, we're solving the same problem, we're trying to assign people to projects, but here's what it might look like to you. So don't wait for the letter to come to your desk saying your next duty assignment is. scan the environment and make suggestions to your boss. That's perfectly appropriate in the example I'm giving.
I think I want to go to the phones. Dear listeners, you are listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Doug Reynolds. He is the former president, past president of the Society for Industrial and Organizational Psychology, and he is not just doing his nonprofit work. He is senior vice president at Development Dimensions International, which is a company that does help companies do employee selection and leadership development. If you have a question or a comment for Doug, I invite you to call. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Now, I guess I want to ask you a few of your standard, informational interview questions about the field. If I filled a room with industrial and organizational psychologists, IO psychologists, and I asked them, what's the best thing and the worst thing about your profession, what would you guess their most common answer would be?
Well, I don't actually have to guess, because we do that. We do a lot of surveys of our members, so I'll tell you some of the things that come out. Some of the best things, the variety is amazing. Working with so many different companies on so many different issues, and not just companies, but different types of organizations. If you get bored with one thing, the next project is going to be a different thing. So variety is great. The opportunity to have an impact. Some of the things that IO psychologists get involved with, like consulting around the design of a hiring process that's used to make decisions about hundreds of thousands of people a year in a company, that if you like that sort of thing, to think your work is having an impact, it's great for that. So some of the downsides, if you're a consultant, not everybody is, but certainly the travel is something that comes up. And the downside of variety is you're bouncing from thing to thing, so some people will complain that, I'd kind of like to see something live and grow, not just jump from project to project. If you're a consultant, that's a complaint. But the number one thing that IO psychologists complain about in our member surveys as a downside of the field, nobody understands what we do. So it's why opportunities like this are so valuable to get out and say something about IO psychology.
You bet. And you summarized it in the beginning, but for those just joining us, I'm going to take a shot at summarizing what I think the field is. The art of hiring and bringing out the best in people is critical to any organization, whether it be a company or a nonprofit or a government agency. And there is one profession that makes, or at least one of the core professions, that helps professionalize the way in which hiring and talent development occurs, making it more data-driven, is industrial and organizational psychologists. And therefore, you play an absolutely pivotal role. Is that in the life of an organization and the quality of an organization and its products and services? Would you say, to what extent is that accurate or not accurate?
Marty, we could hire you as a spokesperson. I think you really nailed it. That's what we purport to be, yes.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and my guest, Doug Reynolds. What is your question or comment for him?
Hi, my name's Sarah, and I'm a professional in the field, young professional emerging in the field. Huh. And I'm wondering if you can speak to the nuances within the field, such as what's the difference between IO psychology and organizational development or organizational behavior?
Good question. Doug?
Interesting, yeah. Speaking to the folks that might be sitting in the audience at one of our conferences there, organizational behavior, organizational development, they have the roots in a variety of specialties. A lot of times you'll see those specialties housed in a business school, in a university setting, whereas IO psychology will draw from those literatures, but typically be centered in a psychology department. So we're studying very similar behaviors. A lot of times we'll collaborate across those lines, so we're sort of in the same domain, but they might take a different viewpoint from an intellectual discipline standpoint on things like behavior and organizations. The other thing is those other specialties, organizational behavior, might be taking a broader level of analysis more frequently. So they're looking at the behavior of organizations at large. They might be looking at issues like when does an organization tend to go into acquisition mode versus build from within. IOs can look at that too, but that's more classically an organizational behavior.
Sarah, I'm wondering whether what's the question behind the question is some issue you're facing either in trying to land a job or in dealing with on the job with potentially other people who are trying to cover the same turf. What's the question behind the question?
Good question. I think that I'm so drawn to the field, and I think I'm trying to hone in on what is my particular niche within that.
Great. Well, let's come.
Is it leadership development, or is it internal communications, or internal strategy, or?
Well, let's play with that a little bit. Doug, I'm going to take the lead on this because it's kind of what I do. These 3-minute workovers is which is what I do after. So. I like starting with sometimes we can get lucky. Let's pretend there is a goddess, and the goddess is looking down upon Sarah. And the goddess says, goddess knows all about your strengths, your weaknesses, your values, the arc of your life over the next 10 years, say, what would the goddess say you were put on this earth to do in the general space of industrial and organizational and behavioral development and all that stuff? What would the goddess point you to?
My answer would be, facilitating positive work environments in organizations with a social mission.
Okay, great. So, Doug, for you, a lot of our listeners here, we are the Bay Area is one of the most liberal places in the world, and so many of my listeners are working for nonprofits or want to work for nonprofits or government agencies. And Sarah is certainly a member of that cohort. So, let's pick a specific nonprofit. What would be the one nonprofit you would absolutely jump up and down for joy to work for them in helping them to create a workplace in which everybody is flowering better?
I can think of a few examples, but let's say, for example, the Sierra Club.
Okay, great. So, and would you be working with leaders? Would you be working with entry-level people? Would you be working with volunteers? Would you be working with all of them? What would the goddess say you should be working with regard to that?
Not so much the volunteers, but otherwise, I would say people at all levels.
Okay. And, would that be, in terms of practical hireability, would you be more likely to be hired working with entry-level people, leaders, or everybody?
Definitely leaders, I think.
Okay.
And I would say that, it would be a higher percentage time spent with the leaders, but I think there's so much value in hearing from people at all levels.
Okay,
too.
There are different people who have greater talents working one-on-one, doing workshops, doing retreats, some combination thereof. What would be the way in which Sarah would be most effective in working with those leaders?
A combination of one-on-one and group process.
Okay.
If that's an acceptable answer.
Okay, and if I said to you that when you get off the phone right now, you ought to make a list of the 10 nonprofits you'd most want to work for. Don't go the national because Sierra Club is so big, but there'll be local offices. So have some smaller organizations as well as large ones and write a letter making the case. Write not to the CEO or something in the executive director. It's too high level. But a level or two below, maybe the director of human resources. That's normally a good place, or an assistant director of human resources. Google them to find the names of 10 organizations, somebody who is fairly high up in human resources, asking for what you want, saying, this is what I feel like I'm put on this earth to do. Here is what I bring to the table. Here is why I think I'd be a good job. Can we have coffee to give me some advice as to where I might turn? Should you do that when you get off the phone now?
I like the idea.
Yeah, there's a little hesitancy. What's the concern?
I really like the idea. I think it makes sense. I think one thing, I've been on my own, and I'm now thinking about going in-house. So I'm just, that is sort of pinging back and forth in my mind. But my only hesitancy is fear, right? That's the only thing that's holding.
What do you have
back.
To now? No one is making you leave your self-employment if you like that. What we're doing is we're sending you to the shopping mall of employment, and we're having you try on some suits to see whether any of them fit better than the suit you're currently wearing. Your credit card is in your purse. You are merely trying stuff on. So there's no reason for fear until that, indeed, the moment of truth. If there is a moment when you're unsure whether you'd be better off to take that job at that nonprofit in leadership development, or you're staying, you know, by your, you know, continue in self-employment, then it's appropriate to be anxious. But now you're just playing. The metaphor I want you to consider is the shopping mall. You are trying on stuff. You are buying nothing yet. Does that reduce the anxiety?
Love that. Yeah, I love that.
Okay.
I'll take the challenge.
I'll quit while I'm ahead. And as always, I do love when my listeners call back in to let me know what happens. Give it a shot. Call me back.
Okay.
Let me know how it goes.
Okay.
All right. Thanks so much. You take care.
Okay.
Bye. Okay, Doug, thanks for your patience. Let's turn back to you, though. Now, one of the things that I found very interesting, just let our listeners know, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco, talking with Doug Reynolds, who is past president of the Society for Industrial and Organizational Psychology, fast growing field. A lot of people consider a career in psychology, kind of like this, like Sarah, because they like trying to intuit what makes people tick and help them grow. But as you know, the field has got a lot of math and statistics. Am I right that you can't enter this field without having a bent, at least, to doing reasonably well in math and statistics?
Yeah, I think you've got that right. It's a bit of a prerequisite. You can think of math and statistics for an IO psychologist sort of like the tools of the trade, like a microscope would be to a biologist or a telescope to an astronomer. If you're not comfortable using those tools, you might want to think again about, you know, if you're going to enjoy the daily process of being in the profession. So it is an empirical field. It's a research-based field. So at the PhD level, you're doing that research. At lower levels, you're probably consuming that research. So you're always working with data at some level, but you're working on people problems. So, you know, there's still, it's good to be interested in people and how people tick, but you're not talking to individuals and helping them solve issues like you just worked through with Sarah.
You know, one of the things I ridicule really is that too much data. We tend to be reductionistic. We like to be scientific. Now, the reality is that when you're dealing with something as squishy as the human condition, yes, you can and should use data and statistics and probabilities to get you in the right ballpark, but it really ultimately is an art, and it cannot be reduced to quite like evidence-based medicine. It's a blend of art and science. Is there room in the field for somebody who is, yes, using the statistics and data to get you in the ballpark of the right decisions, but ultimately is artistic and human in the way they make the final decision, or is it really just too data-driven for that?
Oh, I think, you know, we're going to lean towards data as a foundation. If the data are out there and can point us in a direction, that's what we want to pay attention to. But you can't get stuck in analysis paralysis either. If everything you do has to have a foundation of data, you'll never get anything done. So it's relying on the science, relying on the evidence, and understanding when you're taking that leap into what you describe as art. But I might take a different perspective on that and say you've got to be conscious about when you're operating from a value set as opposed to an mm-hmm. evidence-based set. Mm-hmm. And both interplay in being a good consultant and in really working through organizational problems. They're complicated, and yeah, the data is not going to answer every question, but it can give you that foundation and steer you away from the worst problems.
Okay, you had mentioned just a moment ago that if you're a PhD, you're going to be, you know, using, developing data, and if you're a master's, you're going to be consuming data. How necessary is it? We live in an era of what I call degree proliferation, where because the economy is crappy and people can't get a good job, they go and they say, I'm going to get another degree and it'll improve my employability. How important is it in the field of organizational psychology, industrial psychology, and related fields? How important is the PhD? How many more degrees of freedom does that give you? Or is a master's degree adequate?
Well, you know, we're a field that's changing, growing, as you cited, and changing. And this is a big issue, you know, on the board of SIOP, Society for Industrial Organizational Psychology. It's one of the things we talk a lot about. Traditionally, the PhD was the entry point. It's a research degree. In psychology, that's generally the sort of the journeyman level, if you can believe it. But now that is really changing. There's a number of very solid master's programs out there that are producing excellent, excellent graduates, and they are getting jobs.
Good.
I'm hiring them in my practice.
Good.
So you don't necessarily have to have a PhD. The PhD is a research degree.
Right.
And, yeah, those are going to be the jobs that are developing the instruments and doing the foundational research. But you can get a real good foundation in this stuff with a master's and then decide if you want to go on the PhD route. Now, both are quite viable.
You're back east, but do you know of any, by any chance, of one of those really high-quality master's programs that where people are getting good jobs here in the Bay Area?
You know, these programs tend to vary, so I'd recommend looking at them closely. We don't do a standard rank, but there are a few that that come up from time to time and are pretty well known. So San Francisco State has a master's program. San Jose State has one. Golden Gate has one. I think the Golden Gate one is a smaller program, sort of more for working professionals that want to ease into the field.
Right.
Alliant University, there's that's pretty common out in the in California. I think there's a branch in the San Francisco area. Of course, there's programs at Berkeley and Stanford, but those are more the PhD levels, more in the business school. Mm-hmm. A lot of good choices in a lot of the major cities.
You know, it's right to be looking very carefully, but when I think about, I know a little bit about those programs. If your core interest is diversity, San Francisco State is the place to go. That is core to who they are. If that's not so central and you're looking to be more broadly trained, at least my hypothesis, my vague recollection from talking to a few people and over time is do not take this as gospel, is that a place like Golden Gate would be better. But the Golden Gate is so expensive because it's private, and so you got to look closely.
You definitely have to look closely. I'd really recommend, hitting the website for SIOP, SIOP.org.
Yeah.
They've got all kinds of information about the different programs. But pick up the phone and talk to the professors. You know, there doesn't have to be a brick wall between you and the next step in your future. People will be very forthcoming about the types of courses that they offer, where their research emphasis is, what it's like to be a student in the program. They love to talk about that stuff.
Yeah, they do. But I am a big believer in talking to the customer. Professors, they're selling a product. I'm interested in, when you're going to school, you know, unless you're going to college or graduate school just for the love of learning, and then, of course, you want to talk to professors or you want to become a PhD researcher. But if you're trying to get hired in a practical world of being an industrial psychologist or whatever, I urge you to talk with the employers you most want to be hired by and ask them, who does the, you know, where is the hiring going? What degree programs are most respected? What is the training they most want? Do you need a PhD? Do you need a master's? Do you need a certificate? I'd much rather see you, like this, like Sarah wanted to work for the Sierra Club and similar kind of nonprofits. I would be having her talk with their HR people who are in that area of organizational development and hiring and ask them which training programs are the most respected. That, I think, will get you a particularly useful tool if you're trying to go to graduate school to get hired. Does that make sense?
I think that's very good advice. In fact, on that website I mentioned, one of the things we ask programs to put there is where their graduates go, and you can see their statistics. Do they put 100% of their placements into academia? So really, they're just minting more professors,
right?
Or do they go to nonprofits or government or consulting? It's all right there. So I absolutely agree with that. And I'd also talk to the current students, too.
Right. Good point. One of my tricks for that is to sit in on an advanced class in the program where students have already completed the program and are already in touch with many of the graduates to see about the employment situation. Sit on the advanced class and after the class, hang out and talk to some students about what the program is really like in terms of its quality, in terms of its employability, etc. By the way, we keep talking about the website. Well, the organization's website, that is the Society for Industrial and Organizational Psychology, is SIOP.org. Is that correct? Am I remembering that right?
You got it right. SIOP.org.
Okay. Well, Doug Reynolds, thanks very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, I've got a few minutes, maybe, to time to take one, maybe two calls. If you have any kind of problem related to work, your work life, you or someone you love, I do what are called 3-minute workovers here on the show, and this is the time for you. We've got lines available. Phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And while I'm waiting for the calls to come in, last week I spent a fair amount of time talking about some under-the-radar careers. People seem to like that, so I'm going to share a few more that I like. People are ever more struggling regarding money issues. And there's tons of financial planners out there, but there are people who have money issues like overspending or or just, I guess that's the big one. There are people who are spendaholics, just like there are alcoholics and sexaholics and gambling addicts. There are people who are on what I call the hedonic treadmill, who keep spending and spending, and you know, they get a temporary high after they buy the new thing, and that fades away ever more quickly, and they got to buy more. And there are these counselor types who help people get a handle on their spending, not just the mechanics of creating a budget, but psychologically trying to understand why is it that they're finding that they need to spend in order to feel whole. So that's an interesting little niche for those of you who are psychology-oriented counselor types, money counselor. Let me give out the phone number one more time. You want a three-minute career makeover? 415-841-4134 is the number. If you or someone you love has got a career conundrum, whether you're a clerk or CEO, 415-841-4134. That's the number here at Work with Martin Nemco. Another example, there are some, you know, America is the land of primacy of being social. Everybody wants to feel like they're friends. They want to have friends and connect. And everybody says we're tribal and the humankind is a connecting network of people. We liked, we're social animals. And yet there is a certain subset of people who are not social, who really like being quiet and away from people most of the time. And a perfect career for somebody like that is a musical instrument repairer, whether it be a piano tuner or rebuilder or somebody who rebuilds violins or whatever. I like to think that that's an under-the-radar career that isn't, and also for people who are not particularly technical. You know, there are the people who are going to repair synthesizers, music synthesizers, and or iPads or whatever. But there are some people who are quiet, simple, the kind of people who would be bookbinders or the kind of people who would make beautiful patchwork quilts or artists, but maybe don't have the artistic ability. So being a musical instrument repairer is a kind of under-the-radar career for people like that. Another kind of arts-related career, many people love the idea of being a photographer. They're not artistically talented themselves in terms of painting or other kind of rendering, but they have a good eye and they love the aesthetic, and they would love to be a photographer, but the job market is very tough. My favorite niche in the area of photography is newborn photography. There are photographers for weddings and videographers for weddings and nature photographers, but the arguably most emotionally powerful moment in a human being's life is when a new child is born. And I think taking pictures in the hospital at the moment, for example, the key moment, of course, is when the nurse brings the new baby to the mom and hopefully the dad there. Capturing those moments can be extremely powerful in my judgment. I have no idea if it would really work. Maybe the hospitals would refuse to allow access to the photographer. But if I were interested in that, I would be inclined to do something like contact the hospital and ask if I could get, actually, ideally, the exclusive contract to take pictures, if the parent wanted, of course. It might even be part of, you know, I know that hospitals delivering babies is a profit center for hospitals, and maybe they can make part of the package. You know, there's a photographer there to take pictures. I would think that would be a way to potentially make a living as a photographer, you know, that most people wouldn't think about. Under the radar, that's my obsession, is finding under the radar careers rather than the obvious. I've talked a lot about allied health careers that are not so obvious. You know, I've talked, for example, about nurse anesthetists. Anesthesiologists are so expensive, so they're using nurses. Also, anesthesiologists are some of their work is being replaced by anesthesiology assistants who work underneath an anesthesiologist along their side doing pre-op, post-op. But there's one that I want to thank one of my listeners who emailed me. His name is Alan Botnick, and he talked about a career that is a similar kind of an allied health field that is very under the radar. It's called radiologic assistant, which is a master's degree program, which is like a physician assistant for MD radiographers. In other words, a radiographer is somebody who interprets, you know, MRIs and PET scans and CAT scans and old-fashioned X-rays, And they have a role. They work underneath a radiologist, but they have a fair amount of autonomy, and the salary is six figures. So these kind of, especially when we are going to be insuring ever more people under our new healthcare system, there's going to be a tremendous amount in attempt to control costs, shifting away from the very high-priced anesthesiologists and radiologists and physicians of all sorts to these assistant types. And they'll still make $100,000 a year because the radiologist, for example, is making $200,000 or $300,000 a year. So I really like that category of under-the-radar careers. I want to end by last week I had mentioned that I was starting to write a soap opera, essentially, a continuing saga related to work. And I didn't at the time mention it, but I'll mention it now. I'm doing it for AOL. They'll be publishing it soon. But I thought I'd read a couple of – I read the first episode. I've written about 50 now in preparing to do that. I thought I'd read the – I read the first episode last week. I'll read the second one today. It's for now, all you need to know is that it's a story of David. It's also about his wife and his kid. But this episode two, which I call Layoff, is about David. David feigned confidence as he strode into the conference room. The others were already there, 16 people. What a waste, 16 people in a meeting? With that many, everyone knows that those meetings are not important. Why doesn't she just send an email? In a meager sop to flattened hierarchy, the big enchilada sat in the middle instead of at the head of the still rectangular table. David noticed that mostly there were strong employees there, and so he was relieved. Good, it's probably not a mass firing, but something's up. This doesn't feel like one of those dog and pony show CYA meetings. People are sitting straighter. He was right. The big enchilada said, "Headquarters needs to reduce headcount again. We need to cut five more." "I don't want to do it unilaterally." That's another sop to flattened hierarchy. "So let's brainstorm who." "I need to stress, these are all good people. We'll give them a good reference." David couldn't bear it. He said, "Stop with how great the corporation is and let's get on with it." The others weren't surprised at David's outburst. It was quintessential David, and only he, resident rock star, could get away with it. A lesser light would long have been, quote, laid off as, quote, not a team player, lacking in people skills or some other euphemism for being too honest to fit in the typical workplace. The hatchet squad put all the possibles under the microscope. Some were spared rationally, others irrationally. "She's young blood, I'd hate to let her go." And, "We can't afford to lose an African-American, they're underrepresented. Plus, if we cut them, there's a chance he'll sue. We have less risk with a white." David was tempted to say, "White privilege?" But in today's environment, he knew that even for him, that was risky. In less than an hour, the goners had been picked. David found some solace in, "The good ones will get snapped up elsewhere, the others will get a zillion weeks of paid vacation on unemployment." But then he realized that he, the taxpayer, is paying for that long vacation. His blood pressure went up again. He knew someone who, every time they extended unemployment, said, "Good, now I don't have to look for a job for another few months. Or at least I can hold out for a really good job." He thought, working people paying to discourage the unemployed from looking for work or accepting only ideal work? That's Alice in Wonderland. David trudged at that moment. A trudge could be forgiven back to his cube, but he couldn't make himself focus. Who cares what variable would explain more variance in 12 to 16-year-old Facebook-linked T-shirt purchases? But reminded that if he stopped being so productive, he too could be axed, he forced himself to stare at the file until Mike, one of those on death row, trudged, yes, trudged, into his cube. And that's Work with Marty Nemko for this week. That was episode two of my soap opera, Days of Our Work Lives. My thanks to my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do three-minute workovers on callers. And should society do more to reduce income inequality, to close the achievement gap, transfer more money to society's have-nots, focus more effort on society's have-nots? In other words, do we need more redistribution? Less redistribution? Different redistribution? UC Berkeley's Brad DeLong and Harvard's Jeffrey Myron and I are going to kick around that question. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.